I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to be elected to Congress, once said, "If they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair." Today on Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, a conversation with Democratic political strategist and commentator Donna Brazile, who has co-authored a book with three other African-American women that chronicles their work in the upper echelons of American politics. Coming of age after the civil rights movement of the 1960s, how did these talented and ambitious women get their seat at the table? With more African-American women in Congress than at any time in history, will more political campaigns be run by women of color? And will a seat at the table be guaranteed from now on? The book is called For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Politics. Donna Brazile joins us when Midday starts after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. The 2018 election saw more African-American women elected to the House of Representatives than ever before. 22 black women now serve in a Congress that includes 25 other women of color as well. And last week here in Maryland, Delegate Adrienne Jones made history as our state's first African-American and first female Speaker of the House in the General Assembly. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. Today we are joined by Donna Brazile, a political strategist and the former interim chair of the Democratic National Committee. She's the co-author of a book that chronicles the rise of her and three other African-American women to the highest levels of the Democratic Party. It's called For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Politics, and Donna Brazile joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Hey, Donna, welcome back.
Oh, it's always good to hear your voice, and thank you for having me back on the show.
And I really enjoyed this book, and Sherry's here with us, and we'll get a chance to talk about the book, which I'm looking forward to. Of course, it's a kind of a, the title is kind of a takeoff on a famous play called For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough by Intisake Shange in the 1970s. What's the relationship between those two titles?
Well, we believe that as women of color, it's important to not only understand our history, that line of women that have come before us to open doors and to make a way out of no way. So we call ourselves the Colored Girls because we've been involved in politics for over the last 30 years. We've had front row seats to some of the most amazing events in American politics. And we wanted to share our stories so that other women, especially young women and women of color, will know that they too can have a seat at the table.
You talk about the original colored girls being Dr. Betty Shabazz, the wife of Malcolm X, Dr. Maya Angelou, and Coretta Scott King. Are those the shoulders you're standing on?
And a few more, Tom. I mean, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who remains my good friend and mentor. The Reverend Willie Barrow, who we mentioned in the book, we worked with her along with Reverend Jesse Jackson. The amazing Dr. Dorothy Height, who passed away several years ago. We stood on her shoulders. Rosa Parks, Shirley Chisholm. We can go on and on because we really come from good stock. These are amazing women in their own right. They made history, and often history ignored their work or treated them simply as widows and not the warriors and leaders that they became in their lifetime in helping to shape history.
So, hi, Donna, and I have to point out that I wrote about Donna and many of the women that she talked about in Fierce Angels, and so I'm familiar with her particular brand of leadership.
You.
So thank you. This is a very personal book. Given your career, why did you feel you needed to speak personally, particularly at the end, directly to young black women?
Well, first of all, we are still out here. Mignon, Leah, and I are still members of the Democratic National Committee. We serve on the Rules Committee. We are often out there each and every day encouraging people to run for office. We're motivating them, trying to inspire them. But the best way to, I think, become their mentors is to essentially write a book and say, okay, here's the book. here's how you do it. This is what we did. We come from, you know, normal backgrounds. We talk about our families, and we just really wanted to inspire the next generation to lead.
There is something about Black women in politics. There's this T-shirt now, you know, vote like a Black woman. But your mm-hmm. book reminded me of my own mother, who was precinct vice chair in Asheville, North Carolina, in an overwhelmingly white city. And
yes.
She and other school teachers on voting day would dress up and wear high heels because they voted before they went to school. It was a really special day. And your book evokes that and pulls it forward. What do you think it is about Black women and politics and that relationship?
I think, you know, being women, when, as you know, this is the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, mm. and yet Black women had to still wait another 45 years to have their full voting rights affirmed. We're part of the first generation of African Americans to have full voting rights, although, as you know, our rights are always under attack. But we believe that our first duty as citizens is to register and vote and to stay engaged, to get involved, and to be part of the community that has not only enriched us, helped us, but a community that still need many of us at the table. Black women take their civic responsibility very seriously. I remember growing up as a little girl watching my grandparents and my mother and everyone talk about, well, do you think it's okay? Can we do it? They were fearful of their lives just to get out there and register and vote. And yet as a little girl, I caught on quickly that is something that we should not take for granted because they fought for that right. And therefore, every 2 years, in fact, this is election day in several cities across the country, in Denver and Gary, Indiana. And later today, I'm going to be meeting with the mayor, the newly elected mayor of Chicago. We need every election day is important for our future and the future of democracy.
It's Midday Culture Connections here. I'm Tom Hall in the studio with Sherry Parks on the line from NPR in Washington, Donna Brazile. She, along with Yolanda Carraway, Lee Daughtry, and Mignon Moore, are the authors of Four Colored Girls Who Have Considered Politics. So, Donna, at one point you quote Professor Brittany Cooper, who's a favorite of mine and a somewhat regular on this show, who said America needs a homegirl intervention in the worst way. And given, Sherry's exactly right, given the long legacy of Black women participation and voter engagement, it is interesting that in so many ways, as you write in the book, that the generational concerns of Black women continue to be under-prioritized. Where's that disconnect come from?
It comes in small part that in our so-called drive to create public policy and to understand the needs of people of color and Black women in particular, that we're often put on the sideline, telling us to wait our turn, wait for these important issues. Our issues are American issues. I don't see why we should wait. And yet, at times, we need to hurry history to push these issues to the forefront, because otherwise, they go waiting. And if you look at the health statistics, whether it's breast cancer, whether it's heart attacks, whether now maternal health, Black women need to have a direct intervention in the politics of the day because our lives depend on it. That's why we believe it's important to have a voice at the table. It's almost a matter of national emergency to have some of these issues addressed. And often they don't get addressed because we're not at the table and people don't think of us as, hey, you know, we need to talk about these issues. It's very important that we talk about it. We talk about reproductive rights almost every day, but we talk about it in terms of abortion rights. We don't talk about it in terms of maternal health care. We don't talk about it in terms of the needs and desires of people who are dying and giving birth. Because they're not getting the right treatment. I was with someone last week in Denver where she received a call. This is a woman who is a former state lawmaker, and they called and said, you know, this woman, her baby had died, it was stillbirth, and they didn't know, should they operate and take the baby, like a C-section? I'm like, that's a no-brainer, the baby's dead, we gotta now save the mother. This was like an hour-long conversation, and she and I were screaming through the phone, take her to the hospital, take her. I mean, take the baby out, save her life. we got to be at the table. We got to have a way to talk about these issues. In many ways, our community is in crisis because we're not at the table. That's why I think it's important for people to get involved, stay engaged, and don't surrender.
And I just want to point out that when you talk about the stillborn baby, Black women, regardless of social class, are much more likely to lose their baby in the first year are in vitro than women across race. So a Black woman, a middle-class Black woman in Baltimore is as likely to lose her baby as a working-class white woman.
Yeah.
And so that's why this is a racial issue.
Yeah, we did a whole show about that about a month ago. Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, those statistics. You know, Donna, like the book we talked about the last time you were here, Hacks, where you talked about your time as the interim chair of the DNC, and it's interesting to read the Mueller report is reading like a recap of your book. I mean, you presage the Mueller report when it comes to Russian involvement in that election in so many absolutely acute ways. But this, as Sherry mentioned, this is a very personal book, and politics is a rough business. And you talk about having to have difficult relationships and even severing some relationships that are of long standing. People like Jesse Jackson, who you work with since 1984, and Maxine Waters. And even when that book came out, when Hacks came out, there was a rupture in the relationship between you and the other three co-authors. Talk about how that affected you and how that's where that stands now.
Well, first of all, we remain friends. We've had a long history. And while it was a very tough road, we all had different experiences in 2016. Leah was the chair of the convention. She put together the CEO of the convention. That was the second time she served in that capacity. Mignon was a quote-unquote chief strategist and one of Hillary Clinton's closest political advisors. Yolanda Carraway has always been deeply involved inside the Democratic Party, but I was chair. I became the chair of the Democratic Party for the second time in my life, the first time when Tim Kaine stepped down to run for the United States Senate, the second time as a result of the Russian hacking on our democracy. No one saw it, experienced it more than I did, and I had to tell my story. And the reason why is because being the chair of the party when we were under attack, it meant that I had to take certain precautions to not only protect the members of my party as well as the staff, but I had to take certain steps to protect myself. We were under attack by a foreign adversary, and yet we had to defend ourselves. We didn't have the United States military backing us or anyone else inside the United States government. We had to do it by ourselves, and that's why and reading the Mueller report, I became so angry, so upset once again that this country has not learned, we're not learning any of the lessons from 2016 to prevent it from happening again, to make sure that there are protections when we come under attack, to ensure that the American people understand the nature of the attack so that we're not fooled by the Russian propaganda and those silly bots and trolls that are on the internet ruining our lives and our livelihoods because they know how to get into your personal information to make it challenging for you just to go to the bank and or get a credit card. So no, this was severe. This was an attack. And just because it's not a physical bomb doesn't mean that we should not recognize the importance. So yes, my friend, everybody was upset with me for two reasons. And one was I was spilling the story of the Democratic Party, which had to be spilled. And the reason why is because when you're under attack and your country is basically sitting on the sidelines, I had to tell everybody what was going on inside the party. Some people wanted to just bury it, like they didn't want us to talk about it during the time. That's part of the propaganda efforts. And the second thing is that because of the relationships I've had in the past, I was a leader of the party. I was not just a staff person. I thought I should show the party and the country how to lead during times of attack. That's why I even wrote a portion of my book about the Hacker House. A lot of my friends, I lost so many friends that let me just tell you something. Thank God I have, one, Jesus. Two, I have a large family, meaning brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, cousins, uncles, aunts, everybody else. But you know what I had? I had many in the party saying, thank you for speaking up, because what I saw and what I witnessed had to be told.
So, Donna, from the inside, how has the internet, do you think, changed or will change the American political process? Is it old wine in new bottles, or is there a fundamental change? Because you've been on all sides of this issue.
Well, look, I think that the internet has changed society. We can communicate. We get instant gratification. We can FaceTime. I mean, the internet is a very important tool in a modern society. However, we also know that with any great discovery or invention, there has to be safeguards. And we need to ensure that there are certain safeguards on the internet, not just to protect our privacy, but also to ensure that what is on the internet is not taken as the truth. And, you know, just recently we saw in New Zealand after the shooting where there was an attempt just to shut down those sites so that they were not used to spread more hate and more violence. So we have to be careful in this modern age that the internet not become the all in all for the future. But then again, it is the future. We need to learn more about AI, artificial intelligence, and how that will be used. We got to learn more about the practical uses, but also we got to protect the privacy of individuals and our technology and all our other creative spaces, because otherwise it could be a cesspool for a lot of dangerous people.
Would you use it if you were running a campaign now? Would you use email?
Yes, because there's no better way to communicate with hundreds of thousands of people across the board. But what I understand that, you know, there are certain things that if taken out of context and then used for propaganda purposes, look, I'm going to say very straight up front. The news media did not say, oh, by the way, we just received a batch of hacked stolen emails from the DNC that is being spread by the Russians in order to sow discord. The media never once said that this information might contain PII, personal identifiable information, where the party who had the leak had to be responsible to protect the personal identity of those individuals once it was put out on the internet. So the media needs to learn. Just like campaigns, and when I was at Harvard at the Shorenstein Center, I wrote a very important study about campaigns are not prepared for this internet age. We're not aware of cybersecurity and how to protect ourselves on the internet. So there's a lot to learn. The media should learn, campaigns should learn, candidates should learn, and of course, political strategists like me. I've learned my lesson.
And as an aside, it should be noted that Donald Trump has already in this election cycle spent more than twice as much as all 24 Democratic candidates combined on Facebook, on ads. I mean, this is a strategy. Yeah, it worked the last time, and he's sticking with what works. You also write really movingly, you and your three co-authors, about the schisms that can arise when your identity as a Black person and as a woman are tested. For example, in 2008, when there's a woman, Hillary Clinton, who had relationships and connections with all of you, running against this young, dynamic guy, Barack Obama. And there were schisms within families. There were schisms within even this group. You said that 2008 election was a real test for your friendship with the four of you.
It was. And look, we're being tested as we speak. I mean, we've met with several of the candidates. We're open to meeting with all of the candidates because we want to share our experience. We want to help them. We want to make sure that everybody get on a debate stage. But yeah, when you have leading candidates like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, as we did in 2008, we're tested not just by each other and the relationships that we've had previously, but we're also tested by history. I mean, right now we have the most diverse group of Democrats running in the history of American politics.
Sure.
And yet we're all sitting on the sideline. I believe one of my colleagues have given to all of the leading candidates like $250. I say, my God, I don't have that much money. Actually, maybe I could do that, but I have chosen not to give money at this hour. I may do it in the future, but We're always tested, but part of being a leader is that you have to face these challenges. And yes, I am a self-identified Black woman who believes in equality and justice for all. And so, yes, sometimes I'm pulled in one direction because I'm this or another direction, but I also tell people I'm getting old and gray. So, hell, I can vote my age, too. I'm free. And I think my mom and my grandmothers, if they were here today, they would say, thank you, Donna, because we're now free. We're free. And we don't have to wait to get in line anymore. We can be at the head of the table and we can step out because we have enough voters in the 2020 election to turn the tables and to choose a candidate that we believe will be the very best president of the United States. That's the power of Black women and women, period, in voting in 2020.
Well, it's interesting because I had scribbled down that the table, you talked about stepping out and the table, and in South Carolina, when that whole event happened and Black women pulled out from white women and Black men to support Barack Obama after South Carolina, that is the moment that, and you were at that table when Black women said, but wait a minute, we have things that are different from white women, we have different things, and this was the harder one, different from Black men. What do you think going forward with all of these women in Congress, and we're having a similar movement in Maryland, the Black female platform might be?
Well, you saw it on April 24th, She the People in the Forum down in Houston. That was an amazing experience. I know it's on YouTube somewhere, so look at it. Because some of the candidates struggled in trying to define these issues and understand these issues. You don't have to walk in my shoes to understand the ground that I have to walk on every day. You just got to understand that the ground is a little shakier because of the color of my skin and my gender. And yet some of the candidates came there unprepared to know anything. And they're going to have a hard time after they leave Iowa and New Hampshire to connect with women of color if they don't go and sit in some of those churches, sit in some of those communities, and sit in some of the places where people sit every day and say, well, what do I need to know in order to become a good president? Because that's what it means in 2020. Go and sit and talk with us. You know what I tell people about Joe Biden? Joe Biden can go to a union hall, he can go to a Black church, and he can go to a corner grocery store. I'm not going to say corner bar. That's where I would go. He can go to all three places. And because he is familiar with our issues, he has walked the walk with us, and he understands it. I tell people, don't criticize him just because he's old, just because he's been around a long time. Go out there and find those voters, the same voters that he knows. Go and find them and talk to them, and maybe one day, too, you can be a front runner like Joe Biden.
Donna, we have to let you go because you do have a busy day ahead of you. But I do want to ask before we end our segment, well, what's your experience at Fox News been like so far? There are, of course, a lot of people who, both with you and Juan Williams, criticize you for even, entering into the lion's den, as it were. I, for one, think it's a really good idea to have those voices available on Fox News. But how's your experience been so far? What do you think?
Fantastic. It's everything I expected, but it's even better than I thought. And here's why. One, I love to talk to my conservative friends and colleagues. I don't consider someone just because of your political philosophy or ideology. I don't consider you an enemy of my people, of my community, of my country. So I listen. I have disagreements with them. When they talk about socialism, I say, okay, so Donald Trump gave $12 billion to the farmers who are losing out with this tariff war with China. What is that? I mean, you just got to go out there and feel like you have something to say and you can educate people. I may not reach 100% or even 50%. If I only reach 10% of the people who watch Fox News, I am excited. And by the way, I'm grateful for the opportunity. I love to be a TV pundit. I'm not a journalist. And I love the interaction that I'm having with the host. I just left Fox News. Tomorrow night, we're hosting a town hall with Amy Klobuchar. She's the second candidate. Bernie Sanders has appeared before. I hope many, many, many more progressives and liberal Democrats and moderate Democrats appear on Fox News. We need to be everywhere to reach the American people.
I agree. Already the cycle is turning out to be considerably different than it was a few years ago. Donna Brazile is a political strategist and analyst with Fox News. She's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and one of four co-authors of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Politics, which she wrote with Yolanda Caraway, Lee Daughtry, and Mignon Moore. Donna, thank you so much. I appreciate it, and look forward to the next time.
Thank you.
And yeah, because I need to talk about Annette Jones. I know, because I am so excited. The third African-American woman to become speaker of a major state house. So we got so much to talk about next time. Tom and Sherry, thank you so much. God bless. Looking forward to talking to you all once again.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Sherry Parks joins me here in Studio A. We'll have more of Midday Culture Connections when we return after a quick break, and we'd love to hear your take on the current cycle, the current presidential cycle, and all the stuff that's been going on in Maryland politics with Adrian Jones being elected Speaker of the House, with the resignation of Mayor Catherine Pugh in Baltimore, and the elevation of Jack Young and now Brandon Scott as the new chair, the president of the city council. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Last night, in a unanimous vote, the Baltimore City Council elected 2nd District Councilman Brandon Scott as City Council President to fill the remaining term of Jack Young, who is now the mayor of Baltimore. In addition, longtime council members Edward Riesinger and Mary Pat Clark announced that they would not seek re-election in 2020. This news follows a spate of shootings over the weekend that serves as a grim reminder of the work that the new mayor and the city council have to do to reduce the violence that plagues some of our most impoverished neighborhoods. Coming up tomorrow on Midday, Jane Miller of WBAL Television and Andy Green, the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun, join me for more analysis of the transition of political power in Baltimore City Hall and in Annapolis and the way forward for a city still reeling from scandal and the problems of poverty that undergird the continuing violence.
Instead of blocking efforts to control the huge amounts of money given political candidates by the rich and the powerful, I would provide certain limits on such amounts and encourage all the people of this nation to contribute small sums to the candidates of their choice. Instead of calculating the political costs of this or that policy and of weighing favors of this or that group, depending on whether that group voted for me in 1968, I would remind all Americans at this hour of the words of Abraham Lincoln, "A house divided cannot stand."
Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm, elected as the first black woman elected to Congress in 1968. That is from an announcement that she made in 1972, announcing her intention to run for president. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Before the break, we spoke with Donna Brazile about her latest book, which tells her story and the story of three other African-American women who rose to prominent positions in the Democratic Party. What kind of political and civic leaders does Baltimore need now at this troubled juncture in our history? You can join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. So, Sherry, you wrote a terrific book called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Your thoughts on the resignation of a strong black woman, Catherine Pugh, as our mayor?
I was very emotional about it, and I had to take a while to think about why I was so emotional. And I realized that the opposite of pride is embarrassment. I was embarrassed. I was disappointed, like a lot of people, you know, angry, like a lot of people, at some level sympathetic, because she's clearly suffering at some level. But the hardest moment for me, and this is very telling, is that because we had to cancel an event for a couple of reasons, I had to contact the group Black Girls Vote and tell them that the event had been at that time postponed, but permanently.
And this was an event that the mayor was going
To moderate
with Donna Brazile.
With Donna Brazile, yes, exactly. And that was so painful that, and, you know, I've been watching myself sitting here when you've been, you know, he just played that clip of Shirley Chisholm, who was, you know, quote, unbought and unbossed. And, you know, the picture of her in her white suit and her white hat and the things that she said that were different than what other women were saying and different than what Black men were saying. And the times when you mentioned Adrienne Jones and I've smiled, I've been interrogating my own emotions about this. Because there are two parts. One, just pride that Black women are in those places, but also, and this is with some evidence because I wrote a whole book about it, the ways that Black women have operated have brought new voices, new types of voices to the table, and with that, new power. And so it has been devastating.
Should Catherine Pugh be thought of, seen? Should this experience be understood through the prism of a Black woman?
Well,
I mean, if it were a white man, would we be feeling the same way, or would white men feel the same way?
That's not an easy question, because of course, you know, we don't want her to be, or any Black woman to be, contained as a Black woman. Or, and I am of the generation that was raised to be an ambassador for your race, and I understand the burden that comes with that. At the same time, the way Black women have operated and is to bring that new voice and to care not only for Black people, and this is really important, but to care differently for other people too, not just for Black children, but for all children. And they, you know, that T-shirt that I mentioned, Vote Like a Black Woman, Black women vote in larger numbers than any other demographic. They buy more books than any other demographic. They have been, and certainly not all Black women, moving through the world in a third space that's really important. Now, should what happened with the mayor then influence the way the next Black woman is treated? No.
Is the fact that Baltimore has had many Black women in the last 10 or 15 years in leadership positions, state's attorney, mayor, president of the city council more than once, a mayor more than once, even the head of the Enoch Pratt Library, Carla Hayden, was a Black mm-hmm. woman who was here for 20 years and did amazing work. I mean, there are people in
state's attorney,
state's attorney, etc. Mm-hmm. And now we have Adrienne Jones here, you know, being the Speaker of the House.
And there are more women in power in the state legislature,
sure,
if you think about it.
Yeah.
Tawana Gaines and people like that.
You know, anchor over at WJZ Television, whom I don't know, Mary Bubala, was interviewing our mutual friend Kay Whitehead, mm-hmm. who's got a wonderful show on WEAA radio in the mm-hmm. afternoons, and said, you know, all these Black women have fallen from grace. Sheila Dixon, Stephanie Rawlings Blake.
Oh, two of them.
Well, Stephanie Rawlings Blake was obliged to leave because,
right,
you know, she had lost political support after the uprising in 2015, and now Catherine Pugh resigning. You know, and she, I think, phrased the question, is it time for new leadership? Are people going to be framing it in those terms, the terms of, you know, Black women have had their chance, and now it's time to go back to wherever we were before?
So let's turn that around. If there had been three white men who did that, would all white men be judged by
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
And that is the difference, and that white men get to be individuals and Black women get to be a category so that the next person is judged. And I have to say,
but see, why is it? Why should we make Black women a category? Why
because,
is Catherine Pugh should be, can't we just get rid of that whole, the gender and race when it comes to this instance?
Well, we have to be careful, because when you erase gender and race, that suggests that then is open and even for all people. But history suggests if you don't front end gender and race, then it defaults back to white men. At the same time, there has to be room for a Black woman or a Black person of color to come forward and do the work that, if you look at, and this is, I'm going to say the specific Baltimore thing. If you look specifically at Baltimore, and, you know, you've been saying we have, you know, 278 neighborhoods. If you look at who's leading those neighborhoods, overwhelmingly they're Black women.
Of course.
You say, of course. But, I mean, yeah, we need to say that. So
I mean, they are, black women are the heart and soul of the democracy of our city.
And brain.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you know, and they vote in much higher numbers,
right.
You know, demographically, as a demographic. Than, and in 2016, they voted 98% for Hillary Clinton. White women voted 52% for Donald Trump. I mean, the choices that black women are making are, in some cases, in stark contrast to...
Well, and we were talking history a minute ago with Donna Brazile, and what's interesting about when black women were or were not given the vote is that there were some people in power in the South who said, we cannot give black women the vote because they'll take it too seriously. They'll be more troublesome than black men. And I'm not dissing black men, but there's long been this fear and respect of the way black women move through politics.
We have an email from Stephanie who says, unfortunately for Baltimore, the last three colored girls messed up. Did they forget the legacy that you speak of in your book? I recently told my sister that when considering the many Democrats running for 2020, I like Kamala Harris because she talks like a black woman. The way she talks about topics of consideration and her don't start none, won't be none attitude. So, the identity is there, and it's going to be a plus in some cases and perhaps
a minus. And this is what I think about that. You know, when we look back to our mothers and grandmothers, one of the things that black grandmothers pretty routinely said is my mother would say, don't give your enemies ammunition. Don't forget that you are a black person and that you cannot get away with the same thing that you see the white guys getting away with. And I have said people have forgotten that lesson, is that you see power, influence, and corruption around you. And I'm not suggesting that some of this has, you know, that people are not necessarily introduced to bad work just by people otherwise. But if you're a black politician and you don't forget, and you forget what your grandmother told you, you're going to be in trouble.
In terms of electability, this is a thing that Kamala Harris was just talking about at a dinner sponsored by the NAACP in Detroit Sunday night. There are polls that suggest that Democratic primary voters are skittish about this enormously diverse field of candidates because they feel somehow that the Elizabeth Warrens, the Kamala Harrises, the Amy Klobuchars maybe are not somehow able to take on Donald Trump, that now is the moment where we have to go with a Biden or who else? I mean, you know, Buttigieg or Beto or Sanders or something.
And certainly this election is skewed because of the intense desire to put somebody up that could win the election. And the other part is that when you've got so many candidates, the difficulty is that they'll beat each other up. And by the time somebody emerges, they're so beaten up that they won't be fresh enough to take on the general election. I think people have a right. And it's interesting that when Donna was talking about her friend who gave $250 to every candidate, remember that Barack Obama had a lot of people who were giving $100 out of every paycheck from South Carolina on. And if we don't have somebody, I shouldn't say that, if Democrats, well, I'm a black woman, so people pretty much understand my politics, black feminists, that if Democrats don't have somebody that they can, one person they can rally behind fairly early in the process, then they'll have trouble.
And Barack Obama cautioned what he called the circular firing squad,
mm-hmm.
you know, that could certainly result with a field as big as it is. We're going to take a quick break. Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She joins me on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with the Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. I'm Tom Hall. We'll have more with Sherry Parks after a quick break. 410-662-8780. Drop us an email with your thoughts, midday@wypr.org, or you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR, and you can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and she also hosts Beyond the Ballot here on WIPR, which airs twice a month on Thursday afternoons during All Things Considered, and she joins me once a month for Midday Culture Connections. You are welcome to join us as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. Sherry, let's talk about Adrian Jones and this really remarkable series of events that took place last Wednesday. The two leading candidates for Speaker of the House, a white woman named Maggie McIntosh, who's the head of the Appropriations Committee, very powerful and longstanding presence in Annapolis, and Derek Davis from Prince George's County, head of the Economic Matters Committee. They seem to be duking it out. Adrian Jones had been a candidate for the position a couple of weeks, or not even a week prior,
and
it had dropped out the Friday before the vote. Wednesday, they have this vote. The Democratic caucus sequestered for 5 hours, and Adrian Jones emerges the Speaker of the House. What do you make of all that?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you backed up and said that she had been a candidate herself, and then she dropped out. There has been some suggestion, let's say it that way, that there was a push to remove the black woman so that a black man could move forward.
So that the black vote wouldn't be split.
Wouldn't be split.
In terms of the caucus.
Right. Yeah. And then there's a historical trend of black women being asked to do such a thing, whether she was asked or she did it. Sometimes black women just do it because, you know, we're still waiting for the black male savior to come. You know, the next Martin Luther King, there's still that hunger for the black male leader. And it's a trope that both black communities and black women sometimes follow. It's very interesting to me that when she emerged as the, quote, compromise candidate, she nevertheless was voted unanimously. So clearly she had some strength and some power and some appeal to start with, but the tendency not to look at the black woman strongly. Again, this black woman was caught between the white woman and the black man and provided a third way. So, I mean, it followed the script in a way. And by all accounts, I mean, I don't know her personally, by all accounts, you know, one, she had been next to that job for years.
16 years as the Speaker pro tem, filled in for Speaker Mike Bush, who, of course, passed away in April. But anytime he wasn't there for whatever reason, she was, at the podium.
So one has to ask, or maybe Sherry has to ask, why wasn't she immediately seen as the front runner for that one when she obviously had the votes?
Let's go to the phones to Blima in Owings Mills. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome to the show.
Okay, hi. I have two comments. We talked about three black women who messed up. I don't know if Sherry said it or you said it, but we should say three politicians screwed up. You know, I think it's unfair to just label them as black women, even though they are. My second comment is that all the Democratic candidates should be locked up in one room, pick one, and then everybody else goes and push that one person's business. Otherwise, it's going to be a mess again. People will vote for different candidates, and a total is not going to add up to beat Trump.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment, Blima. It's interesting because that's sort of what happened in Annapolis last Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Neither Maggie McIntosh nor Derek Davis had sufficient numbers of votes. Derek Davis perhaps could have gotten a sufficient number of votes had he made himself somewhat beholden to the Republican caucus, who would have delivered more than 40 votes for him.
And there was pushback from the Democratic leadership for that to happen.
Yeah.
Now, I want to tell you that actually neither Tom and I brought that up. That we were quoting a journalist who had said that about three black women and responding to it,
and an emailer said as well. But it's out there in the the ethosphere. It just is. When it comes to electability of women in general, we talked about on the presidential level how there's some polling to indicate that Democrats are a little timid about getting behind a Klobuchar or a Warren or a Harris. Here at home, I think personally, if Sheila Dixon enters the race for mayor, and right now there's only one candidate for mayor. It's Thiru Vignaraj. He's the only person who's actually declared for mayor. And the primary is less than a month away, or less than a year away, excuse me.
Please, no. Don't.
But, yeah. But if Sheila Dixon gets into the race for mayor, I would suggest that she would become the immediate front runner.
I suspect so. One, I mean, we are in a predominantly black city, and that's really important. And, I mean, for good or for ill, the mayor scandal has repositioned Sheila Dixon's scandal in terms of scope. And I've heard a number of people say, well, this puts, you know, the gift cards in a whole nother perspective. And I'm not passing judgment on that. It just is something that's out there.
We should remind folks that Mayor Dixon was indicted on 12 counts. She pled guilty to one. The other 11 were dismissed. Had any of those other 11 been pursued, I think you might find a little bit more compatibility between what's happened with Mayor Pugh and Mayor Dixon. Let's go back to the phones to Delegate John Cardin, who joins us. He represents the 11th District, Baltimore County. Delegate, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Just real quickly, I'm very excited about the election of Delegate Adrian Jones as our new speaker. But just to comment on what Sherry had been saying, that we had three amazing candidates, Delegate Maggie McIntosh, Delegate Derek Davis, Delegate Adrian Jones. She withdrew. I do not believe it had anything to do with a woman versus a man, or it might have had to do with the fact that the Black Caucus was trying to consolidate its influence. But the fact of the matter is that Maggie McIntosh has her strengths. She has Baltimore City. She has a legislative agenda that's pretty amazing. Derek Davis, obviously from Prince George's County, and has been both he and Maggie have been talking about being speaker for ages.
Yeah, a long time.
So Adrian Jones came in as a consensus candidate. I wouldn't call her a compromise candidate. I'd say a consensus candidate, somebody that everybody felt they could support because of what she brings to the table, and that's why she got the unanimous vote, not because she had been, out there kind of making phone calls all morning to try and persuade people not to vote for the other candidates. It was because the Democratic Party wanted to be unified. That's the way I see it, at least.
Yeah, and I don't see a contradiction in what you said and what I said. We were both curious about what happened in the Black Caucus. I'm raising some questions that I think are important, but I did not mean to take away from either the other candidates.
Yeah, and Delegate, what's your understanding, what's your speculation about how Speaker Jones will get along with the leadership in the Senate? Mike Miller, who, of course, has been in that job longer than any Senate president in the United States, is battling some very difficult health challenges right now. There is likely to be a change in the leadership in the Senate at some point in the next, few years, to be sure. But what's your understanding of how Speaker Jones will be in that environment?
Well, that's a great question. So, first of all, she's got two Baltimore County chairmen right now, present chairman there, Bobby Zirkin and Dolores Kelly. Number one, so that's good news for her. As coming from Baltimore County, having that relationship and that history. Number two is Adrienne Jones is known by everybody as somebody who listens. She's thoughtful. She's pensive. She doesn't jump to action. And I think that's going to be important for her as she gets her feet grounded as the Speaker of the House and presumably one of the most influential people in the state. And working with a Mike Miller, no matter who you are, you could be the most experienced person in the world, is always a challenge. He's a master strategy guy, and she's going to have to do what she does best, which is kind of sit down, listen, think about things, and I think she'll do a great job doing that.
Delegate John Cardin represents Baltimore County in the General Assembly. Delegate, thank you for calling. I appreciate it. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She joins us every month for Midday Culture Connections, and she hosts Beyond the Ballot here on WIPR, which airs twice a month, Thursday afternoons during All Things Considered. Good to see you, ma'am. See you next time.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, Jane Miller of WBAL Television and Andy Green of the Baltimore Sun join me for analysis of the latest political news in Baltimore and beyond. We'll talk about Brandon Scott, the new president of the Baltimore City Council. We'll talk about our new mayor, who is saying at the moment he's not going to run for mayor again. So we're looking at the specter of Jack Young, the current mayor, running for city council president as the mayor. That'll be an interesting thing to consider, and we'll consider that with Jane and Andy tomorrow. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recognized by the Daily Meal. You can find menu and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is coming up after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.